Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, May 30th, 2019. Potential evidence for trial revealed. Prosecution's exhibit list 11 pages in length. Defense's is 5 pages. Peoria. A stained baseball bat, a roll of duct tape, and a maintenance request are among the evidence prosecutors plan to present at the trial of accused kidnapper and killer Brent Christensen. Exhibit lists were filed this week in the case against Christensen, who has been charged with kidnapping resulting in the death of a visiting U of I scholar, Yingying Zhang. His federal death penalty trial is scheduled to begin Monday with jury selection. Ms. Zhang was last seen nearly 2 years ago on June 9, 2017, entering Christensen's car near a campus bus stop. Christensen told the FBI he led her out a few blocks away and has pleaded not guilty. Prosecutors believe he took her back to his apartment, where FBI biologists are expected to testify that Ms. Zhang's blood and DNA were found. The FBI presumes Ms. Zhang is dead, though her body hasn't been located. Both prosecutors and defense attorneys filed motions this week listing the exhibits they plan to use at trial. The defense's 5-page list includes Christensen's family history, financial records, records from the dating service OkCupid, his high school yearbook, various educational and medical records, job applications, and a book called Ghost Killers by Lynn Toseland, which appears to focus on how to get rid of ghosts. The exhibit lists are straightforward without an explanation of what each item is or how it's connected with the case. But the prosecution's 11-page list gives a better picture of what investigators say they found at Christensen's apartment, either the night of June 14th when FBI agents visited or after Christensen was arrested June 30th. That includes swabs of several stains in the master bedroom, including on the mattress, carpet, drywall, and baseball bat, prosecutors say. They also seized a roll of duct tape, a 2016-17 planner, a computer tower, a cell phone, and a laptop. On Christensen's electronics, prosecutors said they found downloads of a paper on the criminal minds of serial killers, an article on human decomposition, and 4 photos of women downloaded 2 months before Ms. Zhang was last seen. This includes a photo of a woman bound with duct tape, another handcuffed to PVC pipe, and another of a woman chained and gagged, according to the exhibit list. Prosecutors also obtained records from several websites, including Amazon, Google, Facebook, the classified ads website Craigslist, the online forum Reddit, and the fetish website FetLife. Prosecutors have previously said Christensen visited FetLife pages on abduction fantasies, though his attorneys have said they were only brief visits that were part of a consensual relationship. From Christensen's Amazon records, prosecutors plan to present an exhibit called Super Tough Heavyweight Cotton Canvas Duffel Bag, Size Colossal 72-inch by 22-inch. It's unclear if this item was purchased or if Christensen simply looked at it. Prosecutors also plan to present various receipts and surveillance photo of Christensen in the days around when Ms. Zhang was last seen, approximately 2 p.m. June 9, 2017, a Friday. He apparently went to Schnucks that morning, to Walmart on the following Sunday, and to Schnucks again on the following Monday. The next day, a maintenance request was made for Christensen's apartment, according to the exhibit list. Prosecutors also plan to present surveillance footage of a Saturn Astra near Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School in Urbana on the day of Ms. Zhang's disappearance. At a recent hearing, prosecutors said they expect it will take 2.5 weeks to present their case, though they could wrap up sooner. U of I aims to forge lifelong links to alumni. Permanent email accounts considered, but it was done and dropped before. A lifelong University of Illinois email address for graduates and a potential partnership with LinkedIn are possibilities the U of I is exploring to keep closer contact with alumni and potentially drive up fundraising. Neovi brings in more than $400 million a year in gifts and commitments each year, a total that will likely surpass the half-billion mark this year, according to U of I President Tim Killeen. Yet only about 8% of graduates from the U of I's three campuses donate back, a number Killeen would like to see reach double digits. The U of I system is studying how its three universities can maintain better contact with alumni after they graduate, such as working through LinkedIn, the online business and employment networking site, or allowing graduates to keep their illinois.edu emails indefinitely. Killeen said he recently attended a U of I event in London that drew many alumni who were connecting with the U of I for the first time since earning their degrees. They were found by searching LinkedIn, but a more systematic approach would be helpful, he said. He said LinkedIn has worked with other universities to build networking, mentoring, and other services for alumni. U of I officials plan to meet with the company in August. We have to think of ourselves as not just a graduation machine, but what happens beyond that and how to keep in contact, Killeen told members of the University Senate's conference on Wednesday in Chicago. The Senate's conference, a faculty advisory group, plans to invite the chief information officers for the three campuses and representatives of administrative information technology services to a future meeting to review data about alumni email use. Executive Vice President Barbara Wilson encouraged the meeting but added, "They are going to tell you this is not the way to connect with alumni." One reason, today's students don't use email as much as their predecessors did. If they do, many students have Gmail accounts now, and most of them don't even use their Illinois email address, Wilson said. The Urbana campus experimented with giving alumni permanent U of I email addresses for about 6 years, but dropped the service in 2012 as less than 1% of alumni used it, Wilson said. The Urbana and Springfield campuses both offer email forwarding, so any email sent to an illinois.edu address can be forwarded to a graduate's preferred email account. The U of I Chicago does not, but is considering it. A U of I handout project projected it would cost the university $500,000 to set up lifelong emails, plus $150,000 a year to support it. The U of I Foundation's alumni database has much higher quality contact information for alumni that is constantly updated, and that information is available to departments upon request, the handout said. Wilson sees the email issue and LinkedIn as part of a larger suite of possibilities for reaching out to alumni. She encouraged the faculty group to also talk with directors of the alumni associations for the three campuses. The point is, we have lots of ways to connect. Email is just one thing. We're trying to think more broadly about how to engage with alums, Wilson said, many of whom say they don't feel connected to the U of I. Urbana education professor Chris Spann said the U of I has to figure out its ultimate goal. In the College of Education, he said, it would be helpful to keep a U of I email address to stay in touch with graduates as they get established in their field, but he wasn't sure beyond that. If the goal is just to have the possibility of staying in touch with someone for a future ask for donations or philanthropy, I don't actually think that's a good idea, he said. It takes a while for people to have capital or invest to give back to their alma mater. He would like the university to think more about professional development, building a community public engagement, and trying to get our alums to be extensions of what we're doing at the university, he said. That way, they'd have a caring interest in staying in touch. When it comes to donations, Spann said, I think it would help if we had built a relationship already, and Wilson agreed. Killeen said both aspects are important. If we could go back from single digits, giving back to double digits, it would be huge, he said. Colleges and other units are doing a lot already in alumni relations, Killeen said, but he would like to provide a high-level infrastructure. When Killeen was on the board for the Illinois Science and Technology Coalition, a pilot study with LinkedIn generated reams of data on what kinds of job skills are lacking in Illinois and what kinds of workers are leaving the state, he said. LinkedIn Users typically update their profiles as they switch jobs or earn new degrees. We have enough alums that we could be thinking big data, he said. Urbana engineering professor John Michael Dalsas said that any outreach should emphasize resources that could help alumni, such as job networking with other U of I graduates or new educational opportunities. We have to look at what the value is that we offer in addition to the value that we can ultimately extract, he said. If I'm an alumni, I don't want to only be getting requests for contributing money. Faculty members said some colleges, departments, or even small research groups maintain closer contact with their own alumni. Everyone from Nick Holniak's research group knows each other. Everyone in my research group knows each other, Dalsas said. The question is, how can you expand that to more connections? Urbana professor Joyce Tolliver also suggested the U of I do more to advertise the ways alumni can already engage with the university, such as being able to use the U of I library. U of I Springfield professor Ranjan Karal said he had much more success reaching alumni through LinkedIn than through forwarded U of I emails. But U of I Chicago professor Larry Danziger said he doesn't use social networking sites and would likely respond to an email. How many people who graduated 40 to 50 years ago are using LinkedIn? He noted, noting that older alumni tend to have more money. Senate sends its revised pot bill to House. Expungement, grow your own provisions among changes. The state of Illinois is one step closer to legalizing recreational marijuana. The Illinois Senate voted Wednesday to pass the bill, sending it to the House for consideration in the final 2 days of the session. The vote was 38 to 17, with two Republicans joining 36 Democrats in supporting it. The bill is going to set the model, I believe, the gold standard for how to approach social equity issues relating to cannabis legislation. Senator Heather Steens, Democrat Chicago, the bill's chief sponsor, said in her closing statement on the Senate floor. The action Wednesday came just hours after a new revised version of the bill was made public, and it is substantially different from the one Steens introduced on May 3rd. A proposal that sparked strong resistance from law enforcement, business groups, and some local governments. Like the original draft, the new bill, an amended version of House Bill 1438, provides that starting January 1, 2020, Illinois residents could possess up to 30 grams, or roughly 1 ounce of marijuana flower, 5 grams of THC concentrate, and 5 grams of THC in a marijuana-infused product. It also authorizes the state to issue a limited number of licenses for cultivators, processors, and retail dispensaries, and to charge excise taxes on the retail sale of marijuana products. But other major provisions in the 622-page bill are substantially different from the original version, and those changes appear to be key to gaining support and diffusing some opposition. For example, instead of enacting blanket mass expungements of previous criminal records for minor marijuana-related violations, the new bill allows for expungements through the governor's clemency process if the case involves less than 30 grams of marijuana. For cases involving amounts greater than that, up to 500 grams, individual and state's attorneys would be allowed to petition a court to vacate a conviction. I think what is proposed today is a significant shift from what was proposed, two or three weeks ago, Senator Jason Berkman, Republican Bloomington, told reporters following a committee hearing on the bill Wednesday. Moving that off the table, I think, paved the way for us to resolve a bunch of other issues that were very important that weren't resolved initially. Although those other issues were a provision allowing people to grow up to 5 marijuana plants in their own homes under certain conditions, while the original bill would have extended that right to all adults, the revised bill limits it only to people who have been approved to use marijuana for medical purposes. The bill also preserves the right of employers to maintain zero tolerance policies on drug use and to establish drug-free workplaces. And it allows local governments to prohibit cannabis businesses in their communities or to enact zoning regulations to control where they are located. We recognize there are shifts in social consensus, Illinois Chamber of Commerce President Tom Mache told the Senate Executive Committee. And my board, after a lot of deliberation, said we aren't really excited about this. But you know what? There are things that don't need shift, and that is the need for a safe workplace and a productive workplace. And I'm here to tell you that after a lot of work and tremendous engagement from a lot of parties, that we believe these are the strongest workplace protections in the nation. It also preserves the right of landlords to prohibit marijuana possession and use on their properties. For many supporters of legalization, the most important issues, other than expungement, involve what they call social justice and equity provisions. Among those are provisions that earmark 25% of the revenue generated to a grant program for reinvestment in low-income, high-minority neighborhoods. It also gives preference in license applications to people who live in or have connections to neighborhoods characterized by high arrest rates for marijuana and other drug-related offenses. Some opponents of the measure, however, said the provision was one of the reasons why they voted against the bill. There is a limited number of licenses, and we're going to give preference to vendors who are going to be in the poorest zip codes in Illinois, said Senator Chapin Rose, Republican Mahomet. We're going to give preference to keeping poor people stoned. In addition to funding community reinvestment grants, the bill calls for dedicating 35% of the revenue to the State General Revenue Fund, 20% for substance abuse prevention and mental health services, 10% to pay down the state's backlog of unpaid bills, 8% for local law enforcement, and 2% for public education and safety campaigns. Illinois is poised to become the first state in the nation that put equity and criminal justice reform at the heart of its approach to legalizing cannabis. And I'm grateful that the Senate has taken this important step with a bipartisan vote, Governor J.B. Pritzker said in a statement released after the Senate vote. Senators Steens and Toy Hutchinson have done tremendous work to reach this point, and I encourage the House to take decisive action to make Illinois a national leader in equity and criminal justice reform. Faith-based treatment centers expansion to open. There's a lot of self-discovery that goes into rehabilitation after coping with addiction. Whether it's alcoholism, prescription drugs, or potentially deadly substances, unless you're willing to let go and submit, nothing will change, say those who have been through it. It wasn't until Matthew Becker started as a functioning alcoholic at Lifeline Connect, a faith-based 24-hour, year-long residential treatment center in Urbana, that he realized he needed to let go of his destructive patterns. You learn quickly that you have to open yourself up to newer things and the greater things to come, Becker said. After that, you can dig deeper into what your real problems are. Rarely do we talk about the addiction itself. It's more about identifying the core issues that's making you do the things that you just absolutely know you hate doing. About halfway through the program now, Becker will be among six Lifeline Connect residents who will be on hand today to inaugurate a new dormitory and treatment center that can house up to 24 residents. The culmination of more than 2 years of fundraising to the tune of $615,000 will come with the grand opening of a center that will quadruple the capacity of the current setup. Taking people out of their element is essential to this program's 70% success rate, said Brenda Rogers, Lifeline Connect's administrative director. Those dealing with addiction, she said, have to be allowed to fail. Don't bail them out, just let things happen to them. And she said, adding that it's only when they really are ready for help that a program is likely, like this can lead to change. If you don't change playmates and playgrounds, it's really hard to give them time to get to the core issues they have to deal with, said Rogers, who along with husband D.L. started Urbana's Apostolic Life United Pentecostal Church in 1991, before the couple co-founded Lifeline with Randy Brown. We've had residents from 17 different states, so the long distance really helps. For the first 90 days, there's no communication with family or anybody because they have to deal with their pain. Les Cotton, a former addict in the program, had lived in Louisiana his entire life before coming up to Urbana for Lifeline Connect. He said he had been through a 30-day rehabilitation program but needed something more long-term. It was very difficult at first, Cotton said, of moving. I lived there my whole life. It was not only changing locations, but submitting to a program and process that was greater than myself that was very challenging. But I knew that I had to do something different because my best thinking got me here, so I needed to trust the process. Cotton said he should have been dead when he overdosed 10 years ago and landed in the ICU for a week. That's when he knew he needed help, and fast. I came here a broken man, willing to surrender and do whatever I needed to do to get help, Cotton said. Now a member of the Life Connect team, Cotton said his experience with the program helps him relate to the current residents. Roger says it's common for graduates of the program to stay in town after completing a 12 to 18 month program that divides into three phases, concluding with a gradual out for the residents to get back into the community. Once they land jobs in the community, Roger said, a lot of them don't want to go back to where they came from. Tyrone Robinson, who has been with the program for about a month, said he was facing a life or death situation similar to Cotton's when he decided to sign up. He had been in prison 4 times and has struggled with drug abuse and alcoholism since his early teens. I'm at the point in my life where enough is enough, Robinson said. I've had the self-discovery moments. I've had my brothers point things out to me that I didn't realize about myself. I've been to other recovery centers, but none has ever worked. This one has been so far. I believe this will be the last one I go to. Judge, 17-year-old shooting suspect to be tried as adult. A Champaign County judge has ruled that a 17-year-old facing gun-related charges should be tried as an adult since the juvenile justice system has failed to get his attention. He is enamored with firearms and not afraid to use them, Judge Heidi Ladd said Tuesday, after hearing evidence about Devon Miles' alleged involvement in several different crimes where guns were used. Ladd later set bond for Miles, who lives in an address in the 400 block of West Vine Street in Champaign, at $225,000, after State's Attorney Julia Reitz refiled the same charges of aggravated discharge of a firearm and unlawful use of weapons against him in adult court. Reitz had filed the request to transfer Miles' case to adult court earlier this month. The decision was up to Ladd's discretion. On Tuesday, Reitz had Urbana Police Detective James Kerner lay out the facts of what police had learned so that Ladd could decide. That included Miles' involvement in a February 9th incident at the Hamilton on the Park apartment complex in northeast Urbana, where he allegedly fired a gun at a car after allegedly robbing one of the occupants of cash during a cannabis deal. Days later, Kerner said police searched Miles' home and found an empty aluminum magazine in a bedroom that police believed was used by Miles. Kerner said Miles' parents and a brother also identified a jacket worn by the gunman, which was recorded on video at Hamilton at the park as belonging to Miles. Kerner also testified that on February 28th, Miles was present at home in the 1200 block of West Bradley Avenue in Champaign, where police found 4 young men, 4 guns with loaded magazines, and a small amount of cannabis and cocaine. Miles was charged with possessing 2 of those guns. Kerner also testified about Facebook photos that showed Miles and co-defendant Monique Briggs, 15, who is already serving a juvenile prison sentence for possession of a weapon and aggravated discharge of firearm brandishing guns. If convicted of aggravated discharge of a firearm, Miles faces 4 to 15 years in prison. The weapons charges are Class 4 felonies carrying potential penalties ranging from probation to 1 to 3 years in prison. Miles was also charged as an adult in late March with aggravated battery with a firearm for allegedly shooting 2 men on February 21st who were playing dice at the Town Center Apartments in the 2400 block of North Neal Street in Champaign. Both men survived their wounds. He's being held in that case on $250,000 bond. After Miles was arraigned on the new adult charges Wednesday, Reitz dismissed his juvenile cases. Ladd told him to be back in court June 25th with his court-appointed attorney, Kevin Marks of Urbana. Student put on probation for bringing ammunition to school. An Urbana school student who admitted he had ammunition at school has been sentenced to 2 years of probation. The 15-year-old was arrested May 13th at the high school after Urbana police were alerted that a threat involving a gun had allegedly been made to a student at another school via social media. The Urbana High School student was taken to the counselor's office at the school, where two officers searched him and his belongings and found 49 rounds of pistol ammunition in his backpack. The youth pleaded guilty Friday before Macon County Judge James Coriel to a single misdemeanor count of unlawful possession of ammunition. Two other misdemeanor counts of resisting a peace officer and harassment by electric communication were dismissed by a special prosecutor. The special prosecutor and Macon County judge were appointed to handle the case because one of the teen's relatives works at the Champaign County Courthouse. We have Jim Dye's column, Democratic Judge Fever, Has Legislature Caught It? In one Champaign County judicial race decided in November 2018, a Democrat faced off against a Republican. At least on paper, Chad Beckett ran as a Democrat against Randy Rosenbaum, the incumbent Republican. But Rosenbaum, the longtime county public defender, was really a Democrat, always has been, and probably always will be. Those in the know knew it all along. He agreed to run as a Republican when he was appointed by Supreme Court Justice Rita Garment, who was elected as a Republican to fill the vacancy created by the resignation of Circuit Judge Harry Clem. Republicans, Democrats, Whigs, when it comes to the bench, party labels are irrelevant. Judicial offices are non-political. Judges elected as Democrats don't rule against Republican litigants, and vice versa. They're expected to follow the law. In the end, Rosenbaum narrowly won the 6-county contest. He lost Champaign County, but won enough votes in the other 5 that make up the 6th Judicial Circuit, DeWitt, Douglas, Macon, Moultrie, and Piatt, to claim a 5,000-vote win. In the other county judicial race in November, Republican incumbent Roger Weber defeated Democrat Ramona Sullivan by 5,000 votes. Like Rosenbaum, Weber lost Champaign County but carried the other 5 counties to finish with a victory margin similar to that of Rosenbaum. That got Democratic partisans, including State Representative Carol Amons, Democrat Urbana, thinking that if they could just limit judicial races to Champaign County, they could win all the future races. If you can't win the game within the rules, change the rules. Winning the blessing of Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan of Chicago and using the power of a legislature under supermajority Democratic control, Amon's Democrat judge bill continues to move through the legislative process at warp speed. Under current law, Champaign County has 6 circuit judges, 3 elected circuit-wide, and 3 elected by Champaign County voters. Among Amon's legislation, HB 97, would make Champaign County a circuit unto itself, and all its circuit judges would be elected by county voters. The surprise attack launched by Amons became public Monday when she amended one of Madigan's shell bills with her Democratic judge language. Shell bills are vehicles Madigan uses for special under-the-radar projects like this one. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, May 30th, 2019. Please stay tuned for Part 2.